Good afternoon. Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network's Farm Report. You're here with your host, Heather Hyman. This week, we'll be speaking with two farmers, one of Montana, Melvin Brown, the founder of Almathia Organic Dairy. And then next, we'll be speaking with Neil Kirkhart of Iowa, fourth-generation farmer, been on his land since 1912. But I'll leave the rest of the information up to the farmers to talk to you about themselves. I think we've got Melvin on the line right now. Melvin, how are you today?
I'm great, thank you.
Nice to have you on. We are very much excited and looking forward to hearing about your production and a little bit about the history of how Almathia Organic got started. Let's tell our listeners.
Well, I was involved in embryo transplants. I'm from England originally, and I worked with cattle all over the world. And unfortunately, I broke my leg and knee and couldn't be around cattle, so my wife and I started with goats.
Are the goats a little bit easier to handle on the farm than the cattle? Is that why it was easier for you to work with goats after the injury?
Correct, yeah. Goats can't, I don't think they could hurt me, so...
They can certainly jump and play, I know that.
Yeah, they're very social animals, and we're a family farm, my wife and I, and my son Nathan makes our cheese, and we're up under the Bridger Mountains, just north of Bozeman, Montana.
So you say your son makes your cheese, so I'm assuming that has much to do with their production of the goats to allow for this cheese-making process to occur.
That's right. I do the milking and the animal care. My wife's actually a teacher at the high school in Bozeman, and she does the marketing. And my son, he makes the cheese. He raises organic pork that we feed the whey from the cheese to. And he also makes compost for all the gardeners and landscapers around Gallatin Valley here in Montana.
Well, that's definitely a nice community, a nice way to keep everyone connected. Now, when you say that the milk from the cow, the milk from the goat, the whey, helps feed these pigs that you raise, can you tell me a little bit about what you mean by whey and then how that is transformed into the pig's diet?
Yeah, the whey is, when we make the cheese, the whey separates from the curds, so we keep the curd to make the cheese, okay. And the whey is the byproduct. Which is our goats produce very high butterfat, high protein milk, so we have really high grade whey. It would be better if we dried it and put it into the supplement industry, but we have this byproduct, and we have nice pasture for the pigs, so we bring the whey back to the farm and feed it to our organic pork, which keeps the cost of production down, and the pigs do really well, really, really well on the whey. So,
now, how much of the pig's feed would you say is the whey itself? Because as far as I kind of understand it, it seems that the pigs do need some, you know, grain in their diet and some grass. What does the whey contribute to their diet?
Oh, I would say the whey is probably 50-60% of the diet.
Wow.
We do feed a triticale grain that's grown locally here, and they're out on pasture, and they graze away just like cows do on the pasture. We've got great pasture.
Very nice.
Would say a good 50% of the diet is the whey.
That definitely seems like it could be very cost-effective, and I'm assuming then the whey has good nutritional benefits for the animal as well.
Yeah, the whey, it still runs quite high, probably 5-6% fat, and lots of potassium. Really healthy for the pigs. They love it. I mean, they'll knock you over to get to it. Well, not really, but
not like a cattle.
No, you just shout and they'll come running and get their whey. So
that means you got happy pigs enjoying what they're eating, and that's definitely very important for a sustainable, humane product.
Oh yeah, the pigs—they just—they just love it out on pasture. We don't use any—you know—we're certified organic. The pigs farrow in a nice straw-bedded area. They've got plenty of room to move around. A lot of people say you've got to have farrowing crates to raise pigs, and that's just not true. You take care—you give the animals lots of space, and they're really good mothers and take care of their babies. So.
Well, your animals do still have shelter, though, for, I guess, and there's sometimes inclement weather there in Montana, I'm sure.
yeah. They have shelters they go into, and we use lots of straw bedding.
Beautiful. Well, that's nice and comfortable. Now, one question I'm wondering, do you think that the whey has an effect on either the color and the fat content of the pork itself? And then do you think that that translates into the taste of the finished product once the animal, the pig itself, goes to slaughter?
We don't see any difference in the color of the fat on the slaughter animal, but the taste is definitely, it's just superb. Flavor, really tender, and the flavor is just unbelievable compared to conventional pork that's out there.
Beautiful, and I'm assuming that the whey and the access to outdoor pasture is what lends itself to a better fat content in your pork itself.
Yeah, and I think the meat to fat ratio on the finished animal, because they're out there exercising all day, they graze when they want. We find the like on the bacon, it's got a high content of meat to fat. So even feeding the whey, and which is a high fat. But backing up on the whey. Goat milk is all short chain fats, so the body doesn't recognize any fat in the goat milk as a fat. It recognizes as sugar. So,
okay, that makes a little more sense. Now, just getting back to the history of your land and your farming production. When did you acquire the farm and the land that you are currently raising your goats and pigs on?
We moved to this farm 12 years ago, and the people that were here before us were organic as well. So.
That's definitely helped on some paperwork, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. It saved a lot of time. And my wife and I grew up on a farm in northern England, and I would be the eighth generation I know of farming.
Wow.
And my father was an organic farmer when that wasn't, that was just the way we did things. It wasn't, organic wasn't around at that time. So it was, we raised our own vegetables, lamb, pig, beef. We saved our own seed for the grains, and had hay. And I must say, I was lucky. I grew up eating the very best food available, and my children grew up the same way. And my children never need an antibiotic. I'm out every morning at 5 a.m. It can get cold here in the mountains, and I never get a sore throat, sick, or we just believe in good food, and it translates into good health.
Well, that sounds great for your family, for sure, and it sounds like you're trying to kind of keep that philosophy going for anyone that's going to come in contact with the products you're producing. I would like to ask, what does your wife teach? Is it food-related at all?
No, my wife, she teaches special ed in the high school in Bozeman. She's been a special ed teacher for many, many years. So.
Nice. And well, getting back to the community, you said your son helps compost. So does that compost and I guess the soil, does that all go to farmers that are within, a close distance to your farm to help them kind of give the nutrients into their soil?
Yeah. We make a high-grade compost, and he also makes compost tea that he sells to producers, and we use that on our hay and grain.
Is there any kind of like community trading where you're kind of giving some cheese or some proteins to some of the produce farmers near to you? Is there any kind of trade-off?
Oh, yeah. Produce farmers, they come all the time for the compost, and that way I get seedlings for my garden already started, and beautiful tomato plants. And
yeah, it's
all
that time of year. We're actually broadcasting right now out of two shipping containers that were very nicely helped funded by the Hearst Corporation, our sponsor today. And we have, on top of these shipping containers, plenty of tomatoes and different kinds of herbs growing. And I think the tomatoes are just starting here as well. So it's nice to see that even though we're on opposite sides of the country, we're kind of all at the same point in our farming for the season.
Even I get a lot of people come out. We have probably three or four tours around the farm with children, different the university groups. So even people with limited space have containers and come and get compost for their container garden. So
beautiful.
We're getting a great name for high grade compost, and
Nice.
It gives us lots of contact with lots of different people in the area, so we can trade quite a few things. So
yeah, and I'm assuming restaurants in your area, if they can't compost themselves, do they come to you guys as well?
We have always had great since we started the cheese production. We've had great support from the chefs and the restaurants in the area, and people just like to come out to the farm. People volunteer all the time, come and help with the baby goats. It's just a fun family community experience for everybody in this area.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, community is what it's all about, sharing and caring, right?
Yeah, last year we did the, through the Chefs Collaborative and our local food co-op, we did the community farm tour, and over 450 people showed up. We had great food. It was a beautiful day, great music, and I was shocked that so many people came to spend the day with us. So it was a great...
That's beautiful. Who was your music guest? Is it someone local or?
Yeah, there were local, a couple of local bluegrass and country bands, and they just volunteered to come out.
Wow.
The five chefs cooked the food up, and we have great chefs here in Bozeman and Big Sky. So it was a really fun day with great food, and we were overwhelmed with the support from the community.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, and that you guys are an important part of your community. Now, something I'd love to ask, I came across this, but many of our listeners probably don't know about how you came up with the name for your farm, Amalthea. Where does that name come from?
My wife came up with the name. It's from Greek mythology. Amalthea was the goat that fed Zeus. And from Amalthea, you get the cornucopia, the horn of plenty. So it fit in with the food, and we were... I actually had trouble pronouncing the name for 6 months. I'm from Northern England. So.
I was having trouble pronouncing it on my way over to the studio, but I think I got it down.
Yeah, but it fits right in with the cornucopia and the horn of plenty and just producing great food. So
yeah, making sure you get the best bounty from your harvest. So that's pretty clever. We like that here. I guess my next question to you is, I'm going to want to know to you, why is farming and farmers so important to the world today?
Well, I heard this morning on the radio that there's 1 billion hungry people in the world, and we're losing farmland through different through building erosion.
Real estate.
It's becoming more important every day to produce food. I mean, not just food, but nutrient-dense food, food that's really good for the body. And I would like to see no person go hungry, and not just feed them, but feed them with food that's really good for them. So it's becoming more important every day. And we have lots of, you know, I'm encouraged by the amount of young people that come out to the farm to spend time with us that are interested in growing food and farming and cattle. And you know, I'm just so encouraged by the young people's awareness of high-quality food.
Yeah, we actually have a program here on our network. It's Greenhorn Radio, and it's all about young farmers, so other people of the likes to, you know, keep farming alive and keep young people interested in these productions that, you know, your expertise and experience has, you know, gotten you to the point so you could be successful in your own specialization. But yes, I think that the most important thing is to keep these young farmers interested, and that's the only way we're going to be able to kind of keep this growing movement of sustainable, well-produced food alive, and that is what our country needs most right now. So keep those guys coming back and share your secrets with them, because that's the only way we're going to be able to keep this going.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I'd like to see the government put up, you know, with the massive amounts of money that we spend, I think they can set aside a small amount in the farm bill to make loans available to young people that have an interest in getting back to the community, to the land, and producing this this great food.
I really like that idea. I wonder how, in this economic time, we can get those banks to allow for these loans to these young farmers, because it must not be easy to get any money borrowed at this time in our economic state in this country. So I guess if you could write one farm issue into law, that's what it would be.
Yeah, we have a great great senators here in Montana. One of them actually is an organic farmer and has been for many, many years, 25 years. So I hope as things progress in Washington that there will be some thought to keep making low-interest loans available to young farmers.
Well, I hope so as well. And if that does become the case and it's more popular in Montana, we may just have to send some of these interested young farmers your way.
That's right. We have lots of we have very few people on lots of land, so we would love to have people move out here and learn and move back to the different parts of the country and produce this great food.
Definitely. And I guess that would lead into one of my next question is, who are the members of your production chain that you interact with that are most important to your survival?
Our family, we're a tight family. We have lots of friends that help, volunteers. Mm-hmm. Our employees are just great. And, you know, the chefs, the local chefs that come out and see the animals, see the farm, see what they're buying, and give us great advice. And the Chefs Collaborative, which is, in fact, we have quite a few chefs from New York in the Chefs Collaborative, and they're just a great source of information and what we need to produce. And
yeah, maybe for our listeners that don't know, what exactly is the Chefs Collaborative?
The Chefs Collaborative is a nationwide group that chefs try to help local producers or get great producers their product distributed to the restaurants and chefs that require that that fresh great food.
All right, wonderful. So how does your product get distributed? I mean, do you have products moving across the country straight from your slaughterhouse or from your farm?
Our cheese plant's actually just a couple of minutes off the interstate, and I have great friends in Wisconsin at Organic Valley, mm-hmm. and their trucks move through Bozeman a couple of trucks a day, almost. So
that's lucky.
So the trucks are quite happy to stop in. It just takes them 10 minutes off the interstate,
wow.
get loaded, and their trucks, Organic Valley trucks, distribute throughout the country. So
that's perfect.
We're very lucky to have. To have that connection and get our product out there.
Yeah, so you got to keep your community alive. You'll never know how helpful one of these members of that community can be to your production. So that's great.
Yeah.
Now, next, do you have a 5 or 10 year plan? I mean, I know you have a son working with you now. Do you?
Yeah, we would like. You know, I just leased 130 acres of my neighbor next door to me that we're transitioning to organic. The next thing, what we'd like to be is a zero-emission dairy. So wind or solar energy is our next big need.
Wow.
And on a 10-year plan, I would like to make this very successful and maybe duplicate it. I used to live in Central America, so I would like to duplicate it in Costa Rica, Belize, so one of the Central American countries where we can help a village or an area in that country do the same.
By teaching them about your production?
Right. And well, even genetics, maybe move some of our genetics to those countries.
That's great. What is the breed of goat that you're raising?
Well, we have four breeds, Saanen, Alpine, La Mancha, and Toggenburgs, and we cross them, F1 crosses back and forth between the breed. So
selective breeding, in a sense, to try and get the best of each of the characteristics of those
right,
different breeds.
Right. And you know, we're at about 5,600 feet here, so it does get a little cold in the winter. So we cross them up. I just find hybrid vigor works well in the animals, and as I say, we have a really high butterfat, high protein, really excellent milk. So I think with the great soil we have, the great food, and the good genetics all combined to make a great cheese.
Wonderful. So these four breeds are heritage breeds?
Yeah, the La Mancha is actually the only true American breed. It was bred in California.
Mm-hmm.
The Alpines and Saanens are from the Swiss, and we cross them.
Right, because I was basically just wondering if any of the, you know, from your grandfather and from living in England, if any of those got, if any of those breeds kind of, you know, stayed of interest to you and kind of you were able to find them here in the States, or any of the genetics were able to be transferred like that.
No, I didn't bring any genetics from England, but we have the same, the San and the Alpine were the main breeds in England. So, from Switzerland, they spread out throughout the world, so I think they're well distributed throughout the world.
All right. I have to know, is there anything about your farm that keeps you up at night?
Over the years, yeah, the cash flow over when we first got started, that would be the only thing that keeps me up at night. I work pretty long days, so usually when I
go to bed, you're out.
I sleep pretty well, but cash flow in the beginning was always a problem. But
well, it seems that you have won some awards. If you'd maybe like to tell me about that, have those awards and your recognition. By, I think I even saw something about the Food Network tasting your cheeses. Has that helped at all? I would seem to think so.
It's been great. The Food Network came out last year and did a feature on my son making the feta cheese, and it's just been great. We get orders from all over the country. People watch the program. On the awards, I won the an award from the local Gallatin County here, mm-hmm. as an award for innovative farmer in the area. So that was a great award.
Nice. And I'm sure that has much to do with how you've incorporated community and taken the goat milk and the whey and kind of finding the best uses for all that's coming out of your production.
Yeah, I've got 200 acres of another neighbor that he certified organic. He's a big, he's one of the biggest farmers in the area, and he just likes what we do and certified 200 acres so I could get my grain and hay right next to the farm without any transportation costs. So,
lesser carbon footprint. You know, as your trucks from Organic Valley, they're coming through your town anyway. You're only going next door to get your hay. So we like what we're hearing here. You're definitely in line with the way farming needs to be moving.
And we had a couple of cheese winners at the American Cheese Society in the past. So
great. So right now you're producing just goat cheese, obviously, then, because that's just all you have on your farm is the goats, right?
Right. Yeah, we don't buy any milk. We produce our own milk, so we're in control of the milk at all times, and I think that helps with the quality of the cheese we produce.
Now, how did your son learn about cheese production? Because I know that's not easy to get into.
He's always helped on the farm. He went to university here in Bozeman. He's actually studied to be an engineer, but he likes being out at the farm and loves the animals, so... He learned from the cheesemaker we had in the past that worked for us for 5-6 years. So he just worked with him all the time. An
apprentice turned to master.
Yeah. Basically. And lived to be a great cheese man. So.
Now is he going to be the next generation on your farm?
Oh, hopefully. Yeah, he really likes sustainability. And, you know, he's got that young, bright outlook on life. And he can improve things as we go along, so.
Yeah, how old are we talking here?
He's 24 years old.
So he's probably going to be the next big helper in your marketing to help your wife out a little bit.
Yeah, my daughter used to be she's a really good marketer, but unfortunately she moved to just outside Washington, D.C., so.
All right, well, maybe they'll open up a market for you there on the East Coast then. Now, I would like to ask, how does technology hurt or help your farm?
Oh, I think technology can help us with the solar panels, the new solar panels they've come out with that would really help us with the energy costs. I mean, to run the coolers and to keep the cheese takes a lot of energy. Running the machinery to milk the goats takes a lot of energy. So I think technology can help us with the new wind technology or the solar panels.
Definitely. And to go one step backwards with the marketing as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Now, I think that you know, there are definitely been some changing weather patterns. I mean, we're here in New York, and it has been cold and raining for the past 2 weeks of June. I mean, have you been noticing any changing global patterns where you are? And if so, how are these changing global patterns going to affect the food you grow?
What we have noticed in the last, we've had, this is the third really cold, wet spring we've had, and because rain in this part of the world is a good thing, or snow, but it's been colder longer, and the fall seems to get warmer longer, so it's really strange. It's hard to get things figured at the moment, but we've got to keep an eye on the frost-free days and things like that. So it's definitely changing. I'm not sure how it's going to affect us in the future at this time, but definitely this was the wettest spring on record right where we are. So
I think we must be, I mean, I'm not looking at an almanac here, but as far as I can remember, this has been the wettest month I've had.
Yeah, so there's definitely a change in the weather pattern, so whether it's going to affect us adversely at this time, we're not real sure.
All right. And then do you have any interaction with wildlife on your farm? I mean, are your animals or anything ever threatened by, you know, predators from the outside?
We have electric fence around the outside. This is like wildlife heaven. We have a stream runs through the farm, and we have that fenced off as a riparian area. We have eagles in the trees, hawks, owls,
wow,
deer, elk. I just looked out with the pigs this morning. There was about 50 mallard ducks and about 50 pheasants.
Oh my goodness!
Out in the pasture, so
that's exciting.
We put up bat houses and tried to attract as many barn swallows as possible because they eat so many insects. And it's actually the wildlife's part of the success of the farm, I think.
It sounds like it. I mean, only because of the diversity of the different people the different animals that are on your lands, they actually can be helping in a sense.
I've never had a, we have a lot of coyotes, mountain lion around, but I have a guard dog at night, and we've never actually lost an animal to a wildlife, but we have lost animals to dog attacks where people abandon dogs out in the country. So.
And these electric fences, I mean, are your animals separated from the electric fence and it's only the people the animals on the outside that would be affected by the electric fence?
Yeah, we use electric fence to rotationally graze the animals to extend our grazing season. And the deer, they just hop over the fence. They don't bother the fence at all. So.
Wow.
the other little critters just go underneath it. I'm just looking out at the window now, and this pheasant's strutting around at the moment. So we try to attract, you know, we don't graze, or we don't farm fence post to fence post. We try to leave cover and trees and just make it nice for all the animals we have around. I grew up on a farm, and I just love I get up to milk in the morning, and the dawn chorus, all the birds are singing. It's one of the nice things about being a farmer.
Yeah, it sounds pretty peaceful, but you do have long days. But at least you sleep well once you get to go to bed. Now we're gonna wrap it up here. But if you had one last thing that you'd like to address, or something that you'd like to tell our listeners about your farm and the production, we'd love to give you a minute to just give us one thought.
Yeah, we on with being organic here, we have the ground, the production of the foodstuffs just the way we want it. We feed probiotic to the goats and try to feed as much omega-3 in the feed as possible through the grains. And I think that all contributes to being a just a great cheese. We love what we do, and
you gotta love what you do to be able to do it every day. That's for sure.
Yeah, and we just like to get our cheese to people that appreciate what we do, and I say as long as we keep farming like this, we keep the next generation moving in the right direction.
Wonderful. Well, Melvin, it's been such a pleasure. We do hope to have you on again at some point to talk about, you know, some of the exciting things that happen on your farm. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Neil Kirkhart from Iowa, and we'll be speaking with you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather, and have a great weekend.
You as well.
Me and my uncle went riding down South Colorado, west bound. We stopped over in Santa Fe. That band of one, just about halfway. And you know, it was the hottest part of the day. Well, I took the horses up to the stall. Went to the barroom, ordered drinks for all. 2 days in the saddle, and you know my body hurt. It's been summer, I took off my shirt. And I tried to wash off some of that dusty dirt. West Texas camels, there's all around. Pretty liquor and money, let's load it down.
Hello, Neil Kirkhart, how are you today?
I'm doing well.
Nice to have you with us. Neil Kirkhart, you're with Fescue Nullstock Farm in Iowa, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Beautiful. Well, we're very happy to have you on as a guest today. I'd like to give you a chance to start off and tell our listeners a bit about your farm and production and how you became a farmer.
Okay. I'm 26 years old. We own and operate a 340-acre farm here in southeast Iowa. It's a mixture of rolling hills and open prairie ground. On that ground, we raise Angus and semi-Angus cattle, registered Hampshire sheep, commercial Dorset sheep, and large black hogs. We've been in farming our ground. Our family started in about 1912, and in conjunction with that, we do raise some row crops such as corn and soybeans and wheat and oats, so it's a fairly diversified operation.
Sounds like it. And you said 340 acres.
Yes, that's correct.
So you're able to feed your hogs and your Dorsets and your cattle some of the crops you're raising as well. Does that fit into your production there?
Yes, it does. Yeah, we produce nearly all of our feedstuffs for our livestock, other than some vitamin and mineral packages that we have to supplement with. Most of our feedstuffs are strictly raised from our farm.
Now, what were the things that, you know, led you to raising these breeds of cattle and the sheep and the large black hogs, for example?
In particular with the large black hogs, one of the reasons why I got into them is because we wanted a way to market our grain. Instead of shipping it to the river, we wanted to feed it and keep the nutrients there on the farm to enrich the soil. The other thing is I've always been really interested in older genetics, meaning genetics that were dying out that had real, I feel like they had a value to the agricultural industry. And particularly these hogs, I think, were really interesting because there's only 300 of them left in the world. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to help preserve that.
Wow. So how did you acquire the genetics for the large black hogs?
We actually acquired these hogs from Ted Smith down in Laurel, Mississippi. He was one of the few breeders that kept the genetic line as more modern lines came into existence since the 1960s. And he just continued to raise them. They're a forage-based hog, which they can consume about 60% of their diet in grasses and legumes, rather than having to be fed solely corn and soybean meal.
That definitely keeps cost of production down in these times of the raising corn and soy and wheat and all of that. This is all we hear from the farmers. Grain, yep. Feed costs, they just continue to go up.
Yeah, that's definitely the case.
Well, it's a good thing that you are coming from a diversified land supply. Now, I wanted to ask, how did you become connected to this part of the world? I mean, where you are in Iowa. This is, I know you said you have been on this farm for quite some years now. What brought you to Iowa?
I'm not specifically sure why our family moved to Iowa. My mom's side of the family came from Germany in the 1870s, and my dad's side of the family came actually from Maryland. We came to Maryland from Germany in the 1700s. And we moved to Iowa here, my dad's family, in 1856, and we've been in the county ever since. We've been in a couple different locations, but it's just, I guess, a great place to live, and it's been part of our heritage. Our families, both sides of my house, have farmed for centuries.
Wow, centuries. So you have some secrets to the trade, huh? Are there any that you'd be willing to share with us?
Well, I don't know about secrets. It's just a passion and a love for the land and a love for the livestock and for family and what we do.
In terms of the you said something about commercial production for your Dorsets, and then you were talking about your cattle and your hogs. Who are, you know, your customers? Who's your marketplace? Who are you producing for?
Currently, we're trying to move away from selling through the sale barns, which are still fairly prevalent throughout the Midwest here.
And I'm sorry, what exactly is a sale barn?
A sale barn is a place where farmers go to take their livestock, and they're basically auctioned off, and they have no influence really on price. The Chicago Board of Trade is what influences their prices on those commodities, particularly cattle and hogs, although sheep are not currently traded on the Chicago Board of Trade. So we'd really like to be able to move away from that. I'm trying to actively promote my livestock as far as for breeding and also for their meat quality and direct market those to consumers.
Nice. So basically you're going to need a little infrastructure for that.
Exactly.
So right now, who would you say are the most important members of the production chain that you interact with to keep your production alive?
Really, those are going to be the customers that I direct market my product through, that I've got a small pool of individuals who really feel like I'm raising a quality product and really appreciate what I'm trying to do. And then also the customers that I'm trying to establish with other livestock producers that really believe in our breeding program. So both of those entities are very, very essential to our survival in the future.
Because they will come back for more and hopefully spread the good word and bring other contacts to you as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And I guess that all comes from the taste of the product, too. Can you speak to some of the to the unique taste profiles of the breeds that you're raising?
Well, with the lamb in particular, a lot of our livestock is still heavily influenced with corn. We're slowly moving away from that to more of a grass-based and legumes, which I think is going to bring out a little bit different flavor. But most of the meat is very mild and tender. It's very juicy, and it has good marbling and just an overall a very savory type flavor.
Now, I know you're definitely excited about the black hogs you're raising, especially since they were in such limited, production numbers, until you, I guess, started producing them as well. Now, what drew you to the black hog other than just the small amounts of numbers of animals that have been in production right now? Was there something about the black hog that you think will really help, market that meat? Or was it really just about raising the number of these hogs in, American farming?
Well, it was in conjunction with trying to increase numbers, trying to increase the survivability of this breed.
Biodiversity in our food supply is obviously important to you then.
Yeah, that is very important. But, two, I think that they were supposed to have meat quality that is adequate with the Burke or with the Berkshire breed, and also the litter size and the docility of these hogs I thought was very, very good. The other thing is, these hogs have not been altered in any way by commercial livestock production, like a lot of the hogs are here in Iowa that are raised in modern finishers.
Mm-hmm. So they're a heritage breed.
Exactly.
All right. Now, why, to you personally, is farming and farmers so important? I mean, you come from a long lineage of farmers, it sounds like. I mean, when you say centuries, you're not messing around. You've got a long history in farming.
Yeah. Well, I think why farming is so essential is because farmers own a lot of the United States, a lot of the land mass, and that is one of the most precious, valuable resources that we actually have is the earth, and how they preserve and they care for and they try to be good stewards of that land. I think that's essential. The other thing is farming is one of the most basic things we need for survival. I mean, to produce food on a daily basis, and you know, we really do. It's I know it's almost become cliche, but the American farmer really does feed the world. I mean, much of the world is dependent upon us. You know, so our survival is essential for really the survival of the human race.
Now, I know that you were saying that you produce a few crops there. Are you exporting any of these crops that you're not, you know, using for just the feed for your animals? I mean, who is the buyer for these crops? You said, I think, wheat and soy.
Yeah, a lot of that crop is still hauled to the river. When I say the river, it's the Mississippi River. Unfortunately, a lot of that is shipped down to the Gulf of Mexico.
Wow.
And it is actually exported internationally. Like I said, I would really like to get away from that.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to probably convert more of those acres from crop production into grass. And what we're going to do from there is try to raise more livestock.
On grass.
On grass, yeah. I think that it's really bad for our soil to continue to export so much of our soil nutrients. I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons why I was wanting to feed more of our corn, particularly to the hogs, because they do have a lot higher concentrate or requirement than what ruminants would have.
Definitely. I know that there has been much different June than what I'm used to seeing here in New York. Have you seen a big change in the weather this year or in the past few years where you are in Iowa?
The weather is, we've seen a significant change in our weather. Last year at our local news station, they reported annual rainfall at 67 inches. Our normal annual rainfall is only 36 inches. This year we're almost to 30 inches of precipitation. We've been exceptionally wet. There's thousands of acres of land here in southern Iowa, particularly southeast Iowa, that have not been planted yet.
Wow.
We are seeing a definite shift now. Whether from a scientific basis, whether this is global warming or climatic change, I'm not for certain yet. I mean, it's too early to tell, but
it's still a change, and it's definitely significant. I mean, we feel like we're here in New York. We feel like we're living in Seattle. It's just bizarre.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that these changing, you know, global weather patterns are going to be affecting the food that you raise?
Exactly. I think certain parts of Iowa are going to have a very, very difficult time continuing with the corn and soybean rotation. I mean, I think we're going to have to look at different crops or potentially go back to more of a grass-based livestock type production system rather than raising corn and soybeans if this continues. I mean, those farmers can't get their crops in, and it's just so wet, you know, they're going to have to do something different.
Definitely. And, I mean, I guess the grass would lend itself okay to more precipitation. And I'm assuming, do you have a variety of grasses there in Iowa that would contribute to, like, you know, better tasting, you know, finished product? And how do you select the grasses that you'd be growing? Is it just because it would be a certain grass for your part of the world that would grow better, or a grass that would maybe lend itself better to the, you know, nature of your farm?
Well, a lot of it is based on the climate. One of the things about Iowa is that we have very extreme weather patterns. We can get down into the 20 below range without windshield in the winter, and we can go all the way to plus 100 degrees in the summer, which is a very wide variance. So we need grasses that are really hardy. The main grasses we raise are like orchard grass, timothy, brome, and fescue. Fescue is very, very prevalent down here, although it's not necessarily a very desirable grass. So,
This is something that always comes up that I find really fascinating. The interaction of wildlife with the animals that you have raised on your farm. What kind of interaction do you see with wildlife, and if any, what kind of effect does that have on your production?
Well, southeast Iowa is I don't know whether you know this, is kind of the mecca for white-tailed deers.
Mm-hmm.
We have a huge white-tailed deer population, which has actually increased significantly within the last 20 to 30 years. The other thing we have is abundance of wild turkey. I think the two of the species that we have that are declined are the ringneck pheasant and the bobwhite quail. I think if we go to more of a grass-based agricultural system, I think those numbers will increase. Row cropping some of those marginal land here in Iowa has really helped really hindered their populations. But there really is an abundance of wildlife here. We've even got bobcat now that are quite prevalent.
Have you ever had any losses of animals due to these crazy bobcats, or do they not get that close?
Typically, we haven't. I'll be honest with you, I always hate saying this, but I haven't lost any of my sheep or any of my hogs to predators at this point, but I hate to say that.
Good, you know, so I'm going to knock on wood for you, okay?
Just start having that, yeah.
Well, I'm in front of a wood table, so you can't hear it, but I gave it a little knock for you.
Okay, thanks.
We'll keep the superstition alive for today. What are the goals of your operation? I mean, do you have a 5 or 10 year plan, or?
One of my main goals is, being such a young producer, is really to find my niche within the livestock industry and trying to develop a quality reputation with integrity and honesty for my product and the quality of that product. And so I really do hope to find that niche and be able to expand my marketing plan, and hopefully we can add a few more acres and just kind of go from there.
Now, so that goes back to the whole thing of infrastructure. You need, I guess, a slaughterhouse and some kind of trucking and marketing and all that fun stuff. Have you begun to tackle that for, instead of bringing, your animals more for, like, the commodity exchange to bringing it more to, like, your own marketing of the product, like we talked about a little earlier?
Yeah, I'm actively trying to market our product here in the state of Iowa and hopefully nationally very soon. And I hope that that will pick up. We have been talking with some various processing plants for potential harvest and fabrication of our animals. So, yeah, those are definitely things that we're actively trying to do.
Perfect. Well, it's definitely a step in the right direction, especially with these black hogs. I mean, 300 in production, about a year ago or whenever it was that you acquired this breeding stock, is such a small number that I'm assuming the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy would have that as almost like a critically endangered. I mean, I'm not looking at any statistics, so I can't speak for the, term that they would use, but that is a pretty endangered breed.
Yeah, it most certainly is. I mean, and that's, when I say 300, that's in the world. Ugh. I mean, that's not just in the United States. There's very, very few of these hogs.
All right. Well, we better make sure that people love the characteristics of this hog so we can kind of keep their breed alive, because that's what's most important as a value of Heritage Radio Network and Heritage Foods USA, one of the foundational sponsors of this network. So I definitely appreciate, your passion for keeping these breeds alive. And, how do you feel the consumers can best help producers like yourself remain in business? I mean, is it that they have to pay a higher premium for a product like you're raising, or is it just, spreading the good word?
Well, I think both of those are valid points. I think really is we need to be conscious when we go to the grocery store and when we pick up that package or whatever we buy. I think we need to really inquire as to who produced it and understand that these smaller farmers, they do have higher production costs, so they do require a little bit more price compensation for their product. That is definitely something that I would like the American consumer to understand. The other thing is maybe not all the time, but do try to buy locally raised food or at least know the source of your food and where it's coming from. And I think that really speaks to a lot of these these food scares that we currently have. I mean, knowing how it was raised, the production standards that were used, both during the animal's growth process and as well as during the harvest and fabrication, I think is essential. So I think just the American consumer educating themselves as to how this food is produced is really essential.
If you don't mind me distilling that down into one of Heritage's favorite terms, it's traceability. And traceability is key. It's being able to really know the source. Just as if you know the source from where you got those genetics for the black hogs, the consumer needs to know who is the farmer that raised their food, where those genetics came from, what food that animal is eating. I mean, and once we're able to really educate, just like you say, our consumers, then we are definitely going to continue to move this into the right direction and hopefully raise these numbers of the black hogs in production and other dying breeds.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up shortly, but if you have one last word that you'd love to get out to our listeners, we'd love to give you about one more minute to give us a little something that you'd like to share.
Well, I think I really appreciate you guys having me on today, and I really have a passion for doing this, and I really hope that you really think about what you go to the food the marketplace and purchase, and really realize that there's a whole production chain behind that food, and that it's essential to know that traceability back so that you can keep your family safe. So.
Yeah, it's not just about the final product in the market. It's knowing that that piece of tenderloin came from the, you know, top part of this pig, and this pig was raised on this farm, and it can be traced back to, you know, you, the farmer, who got into it from his father, which is why we have this Farm Report program on the Heritage Radio Network, and which is why we were so happy to have you on today. We very much look forward to having you on as a guest again, and hope that you enjoy your weekend. So thank you for your time and for enlightening us on what it is you're doing in Iowa, Neil.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. Take care.